From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, what will a year-long truce in the U.S.-China trade war accomplish or not? Then declining birth rates are creating challenges around the world, and some believe opportunities. In sports, a truly epic World Series will go to a seventh game. And Anthony Hopkins, who says he was pretty much an aimless youth until the day he saw a film. Laurence Olivier playing Hamlet.
And something in me clicked. I remember thinking, that is what I want to do in my life.
Well, he sure did. His memoir, We Did Okay, Kid. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 1, 2025.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Tammy Larson had just finished a pickup of food from the Baxter Menards Tuesday afternoon.
Menards has been doing a food drive in the month of October, so we're picking up like week three of that. There'll be a little bit more for us to pick up at the end of the month. We got a big drop-off from Grand Casino. They were doing a food drive just coincidentally also in the month of October. So that was a big thing.
She's the director of the Lakes Area Food Shelf in Pequot Lakes. The No Barrier Shelf recently announced plans to open a second location to serve Brainerd and Baxter. The area needs more access to food. And Northern Minnesota nonprofits are feeling the weight of food insecurity amid a challenging economy, changes to important federal programs, and the government shutdown.
The food banks are struggling because of the USDA cuts to get the food that they have before. So we have tremendously less food to pick from for ordering for our monthly orders from Second Harvest Northland. And that's challenging enough, right?
But like many food shelves, Lakes Area is also seeing more and more families. A year ago, Larson says they served about 150 to 180 families a week. This year, it's closer to 180 to 200. And a couple of weeks ago, they had 225 families come in.
Two Wednesdays ago, we had 9 new families. Last Wednesday, we had 15 new families. So those numbers are just unprecedented.
The recent uncertainty around SNAP benefits adds yet another layer. That's what's been on Kutaska Executive Director Marta Kerrigan's mind.
I think some of it is really right in front of us and people are really aware of it. I think the layers and the ripples worry me because I don't think that people have really felt the impact of those yet. There's, you know, families sitting across from us that are in distress and it's really hard to see. Sorry, I probably get a little emotional here, but and I worry for my staff because that takes a toll on them too, to be wanting to help people and not have all of the resources or answers or things that people need.
The timing of this uncertainty only amplifies it. That's really the best word for it, uncertainty. Our economic outlook is unclear, but it doesn't feel great. Who knows when the government shutdown will end? Federal funding for long-running programs is up in the air, and it's all happening as temperatures drop in Minnesota. Energy assistance funds that families rely on for heating are expecting to be delayed by at least a month and not start until late November. The holidays are another compounding factor.
November is like Thanksgiving, which is a holiday like very centered around food. And so on top of people not being able to meet their like regular needs for like weekday meals and dinners, the closer we get to Thanksgiving, the more pressure there will be on individuals and families to meet those societal expectations of what should be happening.
But both Kerrigan and Larson have seen their communities coming together to meet the need. Kerrigan says that looks a little different everywhere. Typically, monetary donations are better for food shelves because they get better wholesale prices than the average person. But Couchiching County organizations say food donations are better for them right now.
It's good for people to kind of source out and figure out what is my community need that I can do.
Kerrigan says she hopes through all this, the community has learned more about food insecurity.
And about ways that we can continue to support that, even after some of the more obvious part of the crisis has passed, because those things are going to continue to exist, especially in rural communities.
To do our part, KAXE News has compiled a list of food resources for northern Minnesota. But we need your help keeping that list updated. We also need you to help us amplify our community's voices. Share yours by emailing news@kaxe.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump has made his tariff war against China one of the top priorities of his second term. But earlier this week, he met with China's leader, Xi Jinping, and the two men agreed to what's been described as a truce. The U.S. will reduce some of its tariffs, and in return, China's agreed to postpone strict new rules on the export of rare earth materials. Julian Gewirtz joins us now. He was senior director for China at the White House National Security Council during the Biden administration, now a senior research fellow at Columbia University. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
How do you see this agreement? Is it an agreement, a truce?
Well, you know, it's been described that way, but in fact, I think the situation is a little bit more complicated. From one perspective, the United States and China have decided things maybe got a little bit too hot in this recent period of brinksmanship, and they wanted to step back from those recent escalatory measures that you described. But on the other hand, we're really not just back to where we started. From the perspective of the United States and our interests, we really are worse off because China has introduced some new tools that are still on the table, and they can pick up those tools at any time and use them in ways that would be, I think, quite concerning.
Like what?
So the best example there are those rare earth critical minerals export controls that you alluded to. This is a new tool from China, something that they didn't have before this recent trade war, where they decided to develop it because in the face of President Trump's tariffs and other measures, they felt, and Xi Jinping felt, a need to punch back harder than China had punched back before. So they've now said they'll delay the implementation of that policy for a year. But if we've learned one thing in the course of 2025, it's that the U.S.-China relationship is going to be unpredictable. And, you know, I would be candidly quite surprised if we don't see at some point in the next few months a return to a kind of escalation or brinksmanship that we've seen already this year.
The U.S. has tools too, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the really interesting things about this moment is the place that we're at right now in U.S.-China relations is not a good one for the United States, because China believes that it has this powerful new tool that I was just describing, and that as a result, it should get a veto on aspects of American policy toward China, which is, of course, not acceptable. So for the United States, the biggest question at the moment is not just what are the contours of this truce going to look like, but how do we regain some of the leverage that we had a year ago before this particularly, I think, poorly managed trade war. We have leverage. We have choke points vis-a-vis China. We're the world's largest economy. So I very much hope that we don't stand for situation in which Beijing believes that it can dictate the terms of our policy toward China.
What kind of effects do you foresee over the next few months for American consumers when they go to buy almost anything?
Well, President Trump's tariffs have definitely, among their other effects, raised prices for American consumers. So dropping down those tariffs, as we've seen, is a good thing from the perspective of you know, sticker prices at stores. And the end of this period of intense volatility and uncertainty could also be a good thing for that perspective. But stepping back, I'm a little bit skeptical that many in the economy, you know, the big actors who shape prices and shape what's on the shelves, believe that this truce is really going to last for a year. You know, we have a few key milestones that will help us understand that. The next big one is President Trump has said he will go to China in April. If we can make it from here to April without a return to escalation, again, I'd be quite surprised.
And in the half minute we have left, are you worried about long-term consequences of this trade war?
I am, but I'm worried about them more from a strategic perspective, from the perspective of China thinking, as I was saying, that they now have even more leverage over the United States than they ever did before. That, to me, is a significant negative development with long-term implications for American interests that was not the case a year ago.
Julian Gewirtz is a senior policy, who was a senior policy official during the Biden administration, now senior research fellow at Columbia University. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The first time in modern history, the world's human population is expected to level off and then begin to shrink later this century. It is a trend that will pose a huge challenge as communities begin to age. As part of our series, Population Shift, How Smaller Families Are Changing the World, we look today at what might be some of the benefits. NPR's Brian Mann has been speaking to thinkers and activists who welcome a planet with fewer people.
On a late autumn day, John Davis treks through what looks like wild forest in New York's Champlain Valley. Flaming red maple trees, yellow birch. Not so long ago, Davis says there were people here working this land.
Some of this was farmed as recently as, I believe, the 1990s. We're seeing old stone walls. It was probably used for sheep pasture some, and certainly for logging.
This place is an example of what Davis calls rewilding.
It simply means stepping back and letting nature unfold as it will.
This part of New York State, Essex County, has lost about 6% of its population since 2010 because of migration and the low birth rate. It's a trend happening in a growing number of regions in more and more countries. This kind of slow depopulation worries many economists and business leaders, but Davis, an environmental activist who works for an organization called the Rewilding Institute, thinks it's overdue.
I have a perhaps unpopular view on human population. I believe that we are too many and that we consume too much. We need to encourage a small family ethic, especially among affluent people.
The global population has doubled to more than 8 billion since the 1970s. Davis thinks that growth turbocharged everything from climate change to the loss of wildlife. Here's the fascinating thing. That small family ethic he mentioned, it's already here. Over roughly that same period, beginning in the 1960s, researchers say family size worldwide dropped by more than half, from about 5 children per woman on average to roughly 2. In most countries outside sub-Saharan Africa, population growth has slowed almost to zero, and in many areas, population decline is a reality. Marion Starkey's family is helping shape that trend.
I just really wanted to do other things with my life.
Starkey says she and her husband decided not to have kids. She works with a group called Population Connection that advocates in favor of this shift towards smaller families and gradual depopulation. Fewer people means a healthier environment, Starkey says, but she also thinks it's good for humans.
The smaller families are, the more time and wealth there is to invest in each child. So making sure that all of your kids get an education, which does not happen in a lot of parts of the world, especially for girls.
Now, again, NPR has spoken to a lot of experts deeply concerned about this population shift. They say it's not clear how economies and family structures that have long relied on growth will function as communities age and begin to decline. But we also wanted to hear from people convinced this is a hopeful moment. Claudia Golden is an economist at Harvard who thinks fears about declining population are overblown. She says there's evidence people are happier making their own choices when and if to have kids.
To have the number of children that they would like to have and to have them at the right time in their lives is certainly a benefit to couples.
It's important to say none of the advocates for lower population interviewed by NPR want policies that force people to have fewer kids. Instead, they support access to reproductive freedom and contraception. Golden and other experts say the biggest single upside to this trend towards smaller families may be improvements in the lives of women and girls. Research shows delaying motherhood and having fewer children can lead to more education, more financial security, and better health. Vladimira Kantarova is the lead population scientist at the United Nations.
It's something which is a very positive development in the history of mankind.
Kantarova says much of the falling birth rate in the U.S. and around the world reflects one more positive, a plunge in teen and child pregnancy.
So this is something which is really a success story.
Even those who see big upsides in this population shift agree smaller families and declining birth rates will mean turbulence and policy challenges. Finding workers, maintaining a strong economy, and weaving a sense of community could be more difficult. One big question is how to fund the social safety net and health care for rising numbers of elderly when there are fewer young people. John Davis says he doesn't have answers to all those challenges, but he's hopeful people will find ways to navigate this transition.
If the smartest young minds in the world were dedicated toward figuring out how a declining population can support its elders, we would achieve that goal. I think we'd have a happier world for people and wildlife.
Most experts agree smaller families are here to stay. People who cheerlead lower population say it's time to lean into that change, planning and working to make sure the benefits outweigh the costs. Brian Mann, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. It is 8:18. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Blandin Foundation Strengthening Rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Weather today, partly sunny, highs near 42, light north wind, lows tonight near 30, and remember, set your clocks back 1 hour as daylight savings time is ending. Weather tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, and looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs near 50, and breezy west winds. Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series on Monday at noon with Jack Craywinkle. He'll discuss his book of short stories, North of Highway 2. Watermark Art Center in Bemidji has an opening reception for the multimedia exhibit I See Epiphanies. That is today from 2 to 4. The artist, Eliza Clara, will speak at 2:30. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And now it's time for sports. World Series, Game 7. Boy, I love those words. Grab your popcorn or Tim Hortons donuts. Sports writer Howard Bryant joins us. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
This is about the best World Series I can remember. Dodgers won 6-3 last night in Toronto. Bottom of the ninth, a baseball stuck in the outfield wall. Blue Jays thought they'd tied the game. Umpires called a ground rule double. And that was followed by, my gosh, a thrilling double play, outfield, infield. What do you make of these endings?
Yeah, it was wild. It's a 3-1 game, and the ball goes. It was a perfect call. It's a ground rule double. The ball was sort of lodged in the bottom of the outfield wall. However, the run would have scored. That would have made it 3-2. It was still nobody out. But what a fantastic finish. You are second and third for all you baseball fans. Second and third, nobody out, down by two runs. A base hit ties the game. A home run gives you the championship. Yeah. And then three pitches later, we're going to game seven because of a double play. Incredible stuff. This has been a fantastic World Series, Scott. And I think one of the reasons why it's been so good is because of the, I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist around the whole thing, but it's the false narratives around this. This whole thing started a week and a half ago about the inevitability of the Dodgers, and if the Blue Jays were some sort of underdog, or, you know, significant underdog, they're fifth in payroll. They've got a $500 million player in Vlad Guerrero Jr., who has just shown himself to be a superstar during this series. Yes, the Dodgers have the big names, and yes, they're the defending champions, but Toronto won 94 games. They're a great team. Yep. They are the financial capital of an entire country. They are no slouches, and they have proven throughout that they were a game away from winning it last night, and they are a game away from winning it tonight. And the best words in all of sports is game seven. And I just feel like in watching this series, you've got two really great, evenly matched teams. And the reason why I say I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist is because when people talk about the inevitability of the Dodgers, what they're really talking about is what baseball is really, really good at, which is fighting. Because the labor situation is looming over this World Series. Everyone's talking about the owners locking the players out, and the reason why they're talking about it is because they say that the Dodgers are just too good, and they're too much money and too much everything, and the Blue Jays are showing, hey, it's baseball. Put the best players on the field, and let's see what happens. And tonight, two teams are going to play for one championship.
Jays are starting Max Scherzer on the mound, who has, he's, I believe, 41 years old. He's thrown a few Game 7s. The Dodgers,
and going to the Hall of Fame.
Right, and going to the Hall of Fame. And the Dodgers are starting merely the greatest player in baseball and maybe baseball history. What do you look for tonight?
I'm looking for length. Whatever happens early, you got to give. If you're the Blue Jays, you've got to get a performance out of Scherzer. If this game goes into the bullpen really, really early, the Dodgers have a great advantage. And I think that what it really is going to come down to is who's ready for the moment. This is the all hands on deck. All the cliches go on here. Like there literally is no baseball after tonight. And so what you really want to see is the Blue Jays. I think the Dodgers have a little more depth. So what the Blue Jays really need is they need Max Scherzer, 40-plus years old, to give them one last great performance.
Oh, my word. And Shohei Ohtani, I mean, my gosh, what a postseason he's had, although sometimes he's been weak at the plate.
And exactly. Well, I mean, it's baseball. This is the game. And I think, you know, you're not going to be out there. It's not basketball where you're going to shoot 60% from the field. You're going to fail 3 out of 10 times and still be great. Once again, best player in the world going on the biggest stage. Let's deal the cards.
Howard Bryant, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
My pleasure, Scott.
Millions of Americans are in a kind of limbo this morning with the government shutdown, meaning they will not receive their SNAP food benefits, at least for now. The Trump administration has been ordered by a federal judge to come up with a plan by Monday. It's not clear if that will happen. As Grant Blankenship from Georgia Public Broadcasting reports, many Americans are now turning for help to food pantries.
It's a cold and drizzly day when 69-year-old Cassie Collins arrives at First Baptist Church of Christ in Macon, Georgia, and starts down a series of slick steps looking for the church food pantry.
I live alone, and my SNAP benefits helped me up a lot. I'm a widow. I lost my husband like 4 or 5 years ago, and they really helped me.
Now, Collins is among the estimated 42 million people around the country. That includes about 1.5 million in Georgia alone, who are preparing to go without their SNAP benefits for a while.
I have a neighbor that has about 4 children, and she's just, you know, it's sad, especially with the people with the children, you know, that's gonna suffer through this thing.
It's her first time here. As she carefully makes her way to the church basement, she says, making the rounds of pantries like this, this is how she's gonna make it through for the time being.
That's why I'm out here in the rain now, and I have no business out here like this, trying to get me some groceries.
The groceries she's picking up come from the warehouse of the Middle Georgia Community Food Bank, where trucks and forklifts are busy moving food in and out of the loading dock.
Okay, what you're seeing here, this is the aisle that we have a lot of the food that comes from the Department of Agriculture, USDA.
Food Bank CEO Kathy McCollum shows me the floor-to-ceiling shelves that supply about 160 food pantries in the region.
But I'm seeing more empty space than I'm seeing full space.
You're seeing more empty spaces now than certainly we've had. Back in at the end of January, every rack in here was full. That hasn't been the case.
What changed is that in March, the Trump administration cut about $1 billion in funding to USDA programs that used to steer food to community food banks like this one. That's why so many of these shelves are empty.
For example, a few weeks ago, we realized that we didn't have peanut butter in the warehouse. And we typically get that from USDA, but that was one of those gaps.
In Georgia, the state the USDA says leads in peanut production, a food bank had no peanut butter. So McCollum has shifted to buying more on the open market.
We are good at taking money and turning it into food because we can buy what we need.
By the end of the week, food pantries in Macon were struggling.
Somebody scare me.
People who knocked on the door at Beulah Land Bible Church found it had no food left to share.
We're going to try to start back, but right now they're closed today.
That left working mom Ashley Stevenson empty-handed.
We're looking at feeding 3 kids with barely anything after bills and everything else. Unfortunately, the government is not doing its job, and the people are being screwed because of it.
Stevenson says she doesn't know what her next move will be. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
The war in Ukraine has touched all aspects of life in that country, including the nation's archaeological sites. Now a team of maritime experts are racing to try to save an 18th century shipwreck discovered on a small island. NPR's Hanna Palomarenko visited the archaeological dig in the southeast of the country.
The island is called Hortitsa, and it's not far from the front line. It has been a wartime base for centuries.
This is an archaeological site. This is where the Russian army camped in the 1730s for the Russo-Turkish War.
Fred Hawker is a maritime archaeologist. NPR met his team when they traveled to Hortitsa late this summer.
The site has been known, and the people from the National Reserve here on Hortitsa have been excavating different parts of this for over 25 years.
Hawker is the head of research at Vasa Museum and the Swedish National Maritime and Transport Museums in Stockholm. He's tall and tan with a trim gray beard. Hoka walks along a woodsy path to meet Ukrainian and American colleagues. They're on this leafy island to salvage and preserve a shipwreck from the 18th century when there was war between the Ottoman and Russian empires.
The wreck we're excavating from that 1738 fleet is one of the things that was not just exposed but threatened by the changed level of the river.
In June 2023, Russian forces destroyed a major Ukrainian dam upstream, exposing some ships that had been underwater.
Once you have waterlogged wood exposed, it's vulnerable and will fall apart very quickly once it dries out.
That's Kathy Green, another member of the team. She's the president of the National Maritime Historical Society in the U.S. She stands over the shipwreck, her blonde hair tied back under a yellow baseball cap.
This is a really interesting site because it's not a singular vessel. It's a part of this larger maritime landscape. There's a whole battlefield here.
Above the sandy beach, tents are pitched on the rocks. The archaeologists usually start their day by gathering here. They chat over cups of tea and coffee, then walk to the site to meet Dmytro Kobalia. He's Ukrainian and the lead archaeologist for the Khortytsa National Reserve.
So what do you want to get done today?
Kobalia gazes at the waves of the Dnipro River, glistening in the sun. Back in the 1700s, he says, you could see almost 300 ships here. Fred Hooker points to brown wooden fragments in the sand.
So this is the wreck that we've excavated here. It's the first 6 meters at the bow of a troop transport, a chaloupe, they call them, that was originally about 18 meters long. So this is about a third of it.
The archaeologists remove the fragments, then submerge them in water to avoid deterioration. Another member of the team, Larry Babbitts, is shoveling sand into a big hole where the wreckage was found. He's a military and maritime archaeologist and a retired professor.
Can I talk about politics?
He says the ship they're working on dates back to a much earlier war of Russian expansion.
Today, this river is 20 miles from the front as the Russians tried to take property and land from a country that was freely independent. And that hasn't changed.
The city of Zaporizhia, which Khortytsa Island is part of, is often hit by Russian bombs and missiles. The archaeologists said they drew up wills before traveling to Ukraine. Hawker said there were attacks during their three-week stay here.
The bus station has been destroyed. A supermarket was hit by, an Iskander missile. And, there are air alerts all the time.
For him, the rewards of rescuing history outweigh the risks.
This war is partly about the survival of an idea, the idea of Ukraine as a country, that part of that survival is not just guns and bombs and bullets. Part of that survival is the survival of ideas.
Dmytro Kobalia, the Ukrainian archaeologist, spent 2.5 years on the front line, fighting in some of the fiercest battles against the Russians.
Це наша історія, і ми повинні її зберігати.
And this is also part of our history, he says. We must preserve it in order to understand who we are and who we are dealing with.
There we are. It's clear.
As the team finishes the day's work, I ask Fred Hawker what he would remember most about this expedition.
Well, it had nothing to do with archaeology.
It happened one Friday night when the team went to hear a local jazz band.
My sweet Georgia.
He recorded this video. As he listened to the music, he realized how much this expedition and the backdrop of war had affected him.
One of the ways that we deal with the risk is you just suppress those thoughts and those emotions. But they started playing an old jazz standard, Georgia on My Mind, and almost all of us broke down in tears.
A few days later, Hawker, Green, and Babbitts leave Ukraine. They promised their Ukrainian colleagues that they would return. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, on Khortytsa Island in southeastern Ukraine.
listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Music has power. It can soothe sadness, lift depression, and express joy. It might also help people recover from injury.
When you play for them, you see physiological changes in terms of blood pressure being a few points lower, heart rate is a little bit slower. You know, they're breathing easier.
That's Rod Salisay, who's a post-surgery nurse at UC San Diego Health. Music has been part of his bedside manner for over 15 years. That's him playing an original he wrote called Heartstrings, which he says he has played for patients over 1,000 times.
And when you start to play at the bedside, you could actually see them relax a little bit. They sit back, adjust their pillows, maybe tap their hands, move their foot.
Rod Salisay remembers playing for a woman who was recovering from being hit by a car.
So I started playing for her, even though I know that she can't hear me. But when she finally woke up, she was saying that she heard some sounds. She can't really understand what it was, but that actually inspired me to write a song for her. It's called You Can Make It Back.
'Cause life can be just like the ocean. Stormy seas toss you around.
What I look for is how they temporarily put their mind somewhere without worrying about the diagnosis, the IV alarms. It's just for 10 minutes that they're able to be at peace, and all they need to do is just to listen.
You can make it back.
We know from a long time that music listening is known to reduce the sensation of pain in individuals, and it has the advantage of not having the side effects of medications.
Carolyn Palmer is a professor of psychology at McGill University in Montreal, who says we've known about the way music can affect the body and brain for a while.
Pythagoras, a long time ago, knew that music affected our sensation of pain. We only recently have these better brain techniques for figuring out how's the neural response of the brain changing from one beat to another. That's very hard to measure because there's so many neurons and things happen fairly slowly in the brain compared to how quickly they happen in sound.
Palmer says that musical tempo affects mood, and mood is affected by pain, so music might pick up your mood and perhaps lift your pain. But the power of music to move you physically, not just emotionally, can also be important to recovery.
It's important that people want to move to music, that when they listen to music, they're rarely still. And these connections between the auditory and the motor cortex that we see as people learn music suggests that when you listen to music, your motor cortex is working, whether you're moving or not. And that could be another route to reducing pain. The fact that motor activity tends to lower someone's pain sensation.
Palmer says scientists are still learning about how music might be used to help people recover and how it could affect acute and chronic pain. So far, no genre of music seems to be a clear favorite. That's why Rod Salisay let his patients pick from his playlist.
Old jazz classics, Summertime, Minuet in G minor, and of course on the ukulele there is songs like Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
That was post-surgery nurse Rod Salisay and Professor Carolyn Palmer. This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXC. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 8:39. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's True Stories of Visitations from the Other Side with Great Music 2. And coming up at 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. And at noon, the history of recorded jazz with Paul Kivi. Support comes from the Rife in Grand Rapids, presenting the Mississippi Hot Club for its cozy concert series, November 2nd at 2 p.m. The group performs jazz and swing selections. Details at therife.org. The Brainerd Nordic Ski Club has their annual ski swap today at Forest View Middle School from 9 until noon. Find new and used ski equipment plus other winter sports gear. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. More news is next.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. On day 32 of Washington's government spending standoff, supplemental nutrition assistance program dollars are no longer available to the one out of every eight Americans who rely upon the program. Two federal judges ruled Friday it's unlawful for the Trump administration to suspend SNAP food benefits starting today. President Trump says he's directed government lawyers to find a way to pay SNAP food assistance benefits, but it's not clear when they could start to flow. Daylight saving time ends today for a few months across most of the U.S. Clocks are set back overnight for an extra hour of sleep. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The New York Yankees, you love them or you hate them. Douglas Wallop is one of the latter. He's the writer's 1954 story about dreams of beating the Yankees became a beloved American musical.
We got home.
Damn Yankees is a fantasy about making a deal with the devil to win the pennant against all odds. A new production at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. is getting rave reviews and hopes to move on to Broadway. But is this 70-year-old musical still relevant in these times? NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look.
There have been a lot of different adaptations of Damn Yankees over the decades, but they all include Lola, the character who made a deal with the devil to become beautiful. Now she works for him, seducing men to the dark side.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you.
Damn Yankees was adapted from The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant, a 1954 novel by Douglas Wallop.
My uncle was a huge baseball fan.
Doug Wallop is the writer's nephew. In the story, the devil offers to turn Joe Boyd, a middle-aged man with a paunch, into a young stud, a star ball player who can help his favorite team beat the Yankees. Joe knows this Faustian bargain is wrong, but justifies it to himself. This is from the Audible version of The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant.
Could an aim so worthy as denying the Yankees a 10th consecutive pennant be evil? Furthermore, it was flattering in a sense to have been chosen.
The devil's flattery does the trick. Joe leaves his wife and his job without warning. Wallop says his uncle would not have done that in real life.
He pretty much lived his life kind of on the straight and narrow.
His baseball story is pure fantasy, but critics have also noted that Wallop captures some of the fears of the 1950s, like the Red Scare and McCarthyism. Suspected communists were being blacklisted and people were naming names. His nephew says this fictitious story is also something of a commentary on human nature.
You know, people's integrity tends to get maybe tainted, shall we say.
Tainted because the temptations the devil offers can cloud a person's judgment. In Damn Yankees, Joe and Lola end up regretting it.
We're two lost souls on the highway of life. And there is no one with whom we would rather.
We're always interested in people who sell their souls and why they do it.
Because, says Doug Wright, it cuts to the very heart of our impetuous natures. Wright co-wrote the Arena Stage version. One of the small changes they made to the original is to tease out how Lola breaks her deal with the devil, meaning gives up her beauty to help Joe get out of his. She tells him love is the only thing that can defeat the devil.
I found working on the piece cathartic. And I'm a cynical soul, but to be in a room every day that was celebrating notions like decency and sportsmanship and the power of compassion, these weren't always controversial values. And more emphatically, there was a time when they weren't loser values.
Co-writer Will Power says Damn Yankees is about a man who misplaces his soul.
It's almost like a story of us in a way, you know, as a nation.
A man doesn't know what he has until he loses it.
We haven't lost our soul, like it's not gone, but it's misplaced, and we're trying to like recapture what that is.
I didn't know what I had when I had my old love. I didn't know what I had till I said goodbye, old love.
Damn Yankees, an old story about beating the devil with decency, seems almost futuristic. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
A happy thought is whatever it is, he's lost.
Forgive me, but as a child, you were known as Elephant Head?
Yes, fondly, by other school kids. I was a bit skinny, but my head was uncommonly large. And kids used to call me Elephant Head, but simply because they said that I had nothing much inside it.
That's the man now better known as Sir Philip Anthony Hopkins, the Academy, BAFTA, Primetime Emmy and Olivier Award-winning actor, best known for his roles in Where Do We Begin?, Silence of the Lambs, Remains of the Day, Thor, The Father, and many more, and all the great classics on stage. He's written a memoir of his life, which has been filled with high achievement and long, dark passages. It's called We Did Okay, Kid. And Anthony Hopkins joins us from our studios in Culver City, California. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
What did your childhood feel like?
Certainly had no problems. My parents worked hard to give me the best life because it was hard work. My father was a baker. My childhood, in fact, was non-eventful, but in school, I wasn't very smart. I wasn't bright at all. So I just withdrew into myself and I just did my own thing. My father was worried. And I remember him saying in Easter 1955, my school report arrived. He said, I don't know what's going to happen to you. It's hopeless, terrible. And I said to him, it was Easter 1950, I said, one day I will show you. I'll show both of you. I said, one day I'll show you. He said, well, I hope you do. My mother said, I'm sure you will. And I remember he tore the report up and threw it on the empty fireplace. And something shifted at that moment. I was 17. Something shifted.
In the book, I was left with the impression that something was set off in you as a school kid when you saw the film of Laurence Olivier's Hamlet.
That's right. I remember 1949. I was sent to this boarding school. And I remember the headmaster said, Saturday night, we all had to be in the assembly hall, and there was a screen. I think, oh, we're going to watch a movie. I couldn't be. And he said, right, we're going to see Mr. Olivier's Hamlet. And I thought, oh, goodness, Hamlet, Shakespeare. The lights went out. And then the opening music of William Walton's music for Hamlet by Laurence Olivier. And it was so astounding. And it was a grand opening. And then they cut into the palace, and you see Olivier doing the one scene about, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt.
And something in me clicked. I remember thinking, that is what I want to do in my life. 20 years later, the same actor employed me at the National Theatre.
Laurence Olivier was then the director of the National Theatre.
That's right, yes, he was directing the National Theatre. But Olivier took an interest in me because he admired strength, physical strength. And I had that. I was a bit of a brawler. And so I was offered to understudy him in Strindberg's Dance of Death. Mm. And then he went into hospital, Olivia. And they phoned me up there. They said, you're on tonight. I thought, what? So I went on stage for him. And I went on the stage and I had this confidence that came to me. And I don't know to this day. It was maybe from fear, but it certainly was there. And from then on, you know, it progressed through many years, and I've always been employed. I went through my ups and downs with in my life, but I believe that some thing in my subconscious mind was preserving me. Yeah. Because then I went through the years of alcoholism. And I think in those days when, you know, actors in Britain, I mean, that's where you met, was in the pub. And then the years passed by, and I realized I was getting in trouble.
Doctor and nurse, and when you were an actress on Broadway, gave that's you right. a warning, right? Yeah.
But I knew secretly that there's something not right till 1975. And I was driving my car here in Los Angeles, drunk. And I'd lost my car, and somebody said, "No, you didn't lose it. We found you on the road with the lights on." And I realized I could have killed somebody in my car. And that was it. I said, "I need help." And I made a phone call, the fatal phone call. And on the Monday morning, 29th of December 1975, some voice in my head said, "It's all over now, you can start living. And it's all been for a purpose. So don't forget one moment of it. Now go about your life." And that's why I call this book, "We Did Okay, Kid." Yeah. And the book is really an address to my father, I think. I'm very moved about what he tried to do for me.
What did he try to do for you? Because I got the impression he could be a hard man to impress.
Well, that was good, too, because he was tough. So was his father. And so am I. Get on with it. That was his motto. Stop complaining. He'd been through the war years and all that, you know. And his father before him, those guys had a big struggle to survive. Mm-hmm. So I don't mess about with, you know, touchy-feely stuff. I believe that. If you're going to live, you've got to live. Make mistakes, fall off the horse, get back on the saddle and ride. And now at 88, I'm very aware of what a great power life is, and even greater is mortality.
Hmm. I feel the need to ask the guy who played Hannibal Lecter, how do you play a human monster?
Oh, well, it's a simple trick. You play the opposite. Never do the obvious. Play somebody who's standing up straight in the cells. Good morning.
Good morning.
Clarice, darling.
May I see your credentials?
And it's the terror of someone who's so rational, so sane, but inside has a monstrous mind.
If I help you, Clarice, it will be terms with us two. Quid pro quo, I tell you things, you tell me things. Not about this case, though, about yourself. Quid pro quo, yes or no?
I'm chill.
But I'm not like that. But we have access to all the dark stuff. Because we are. We try to make sense as we stumble along this broken highway of our lives.
How are you feeling now?
Wonderful. Just lucky to be alive. I wake up every morning thinking, I'm still here.
Yeah, I'll say. You have some poems at the end of this book, and excerpts of poems.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking now of Eliot.
Ah, yes. It's the end of Alfred Prufrock. And this poem really reaches deep inside me. And I don't know, I'm very much like the Olivia Hamlet. And when my father's very ill, and I took him out for a drive, and we went down to the beach at Sutherlandown Inn, and he was tired, he was exhausted. He said, "What's that poem you used to recorded?" I said, "Alfred Prufrock." He said, what was that? And we were standing on the cliff edge, on the cliff looking down at the bay. He said, "Can you say it to me?" I said, "Yeah, all right. What do you want me?" He said, "That bit about getting old." So I said, "Okay, well, here we go. I grow old. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat the peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me." That's all I can recite. It's too overpowering. I can't do any more than that.
I think the fact that you did those lines, I will count it as a real blessing of my life. Thank you.
I can't even do it because it kills me.
Well, you've...
But on a cheerful note, I'm a very lucky guy.
Anthony Hopkins' new memoir, We Did Okay, Kid.
We did indeed.
You sure did. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much.
Forty years ago this weekend.
I'm Scott Simon, and we're glad you're with us for this, our first program on Saturday, November 2nd, 1985.
A new show took off on NPR, and we're still here, and with you. We've brought you stories of crises, breakthroughs, upheavals, tragedies, and works of art, even bad ones.
Oh, I think it's safe to say there's nothing pretty about this movie, Scott. It's just stupid.
We've been with you through the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The East German government is preparing to open three more border crossings this weekend, permitting thousands more people to surge across the border.
We've covered the explosion at Chernobyl, Hurricane Katrina, space shuttle disasters, the dot-com boom and bust, the attacks of 9/11, trials, crimes, and celebrations, the invasion of Kuwait.
This morning, Kuwait Radio broadcast a message by the new Iraqi-installed government.
Conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Crimea, and Ukraine. Worldwide epidemics, and now the rise of robotics. We've interviewed politicians, artists, actors, singers, farmers, writers, scientists, and lots of citizens speaking out from all over America and the world. This weekly get-together is fun, and it's an honor. As I got to say at the Radio Hall of Fame ceremonies this week, public broadcasting is owned by the American people. We have a business plan, but we also have a purpose— to bring information, entertainment, and the light of laughter within reach of every citizen of this country. There is more to come. Stay tuned. And of course, through all the tumult over the last 40 years, one thing has remained constant. B.J. Lederman does our theme music. Happy anniversary to those of you who've been with us. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Legacy Box, working to preserve family memories by converting tapes and photos to digital, offering cloud delivery to enable access from anywhere. More at LegacyBox.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, a mix of story and song hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, true stories from the other side. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Weather today, partly sunny, highs near 42 with light north wind. Lows tonight near 30. Remember, daylight savings time ends tonight. Set your clocks back 1 hour before you go to bed. And weather tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs near 50 with breezy west winds. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crawlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 to 10 p.m., Friday and Saturday, 11 to 10, and Sunday, 11 to 7. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. United Way of 1000 Lakes presents Dining United now through November 20th. Find a list of participating Itasca County restaurants at uwlakes.org. And Kirill Masabi in Eveleth has open houses November 3rd through the 6th, 6 to 8 each night. Curling instruction and equipment provided.